Picture this, if you will. You're a primary care physician about to see a 32-year-old female. She's been complaining of palpitations, heat intolerance, and chronic diarrhea for the past 3 months, and you just received the results of her lab tests. You explain to her that, given her undetectably low levels of thyroid-stimulating hormone, that the reason she's been experiencing these symptoms is most likely due to an overactive thyroid gland. But doctor, she asks, how does a low level of thyroid-stimulating hormone mean that my thyroid gland is overactive? And welcome to Audio Bricks. I'm Arjun Iyer, bringing topics from endocrinology from our bricks to your ears. After completing this section, you'll be able to 1. Describe the major classes of hormones by site of action and by chemical structure. Then, explain how they're synthesized. 2. Compare and contrast the mechanism of action of hydrophilic and lipophilic hormones. 3. Describe the common factors affecting target cell response to hormones. And 4. Describe the types of stimulation, regulation, and feedback that affect hormone secretion. Part 1. What are hormones? Hormones are chemical substances released directly into the blood in small amounts that elicit a typical physiologic response in other cells. Put simply, a hormone is a molecular message that tells a cell to do something specific. Hormones are generally made in specialized epithelial cell structures called glands. Familiar examples are the thyroid and the adrenal glands, which make thyroid hormones and cortisol, among others. Some hormones made in the gastrointestinal tract, however, are released from specialized non-glandular cells, for example, like serotonin from the enterochromaffin cells. But that's a little too nitty-gritty to get into just yet. For now, let's talk about hormones and how they're classified. First, by site of action, then by chemical structure. By site of action, hormone activity can be classified as endocrine, paracrine, and autocrine. Endocrine activity is the most common, and involves hormones acting on the target cell after being released into the bloodstream. This category includes some of the best-known hormones, like thyroid hormone and cortisol, for example. Paracrine activity means that the hormone acts on adjacent cells. You know, since para means near. Basically, they don't need to enter the bloodstream. Fibroblast growth factor is a classic example. But keep in mind that endocrine hormones can also have paracrine activity. For example, testosterone is produced in the testicular Leydig cells, which then acts directly on adjacent cells in the testes to enhance sperm development. Autocrine activity means that the hormone acts directly on the same cell that secreted it, since auto means self. Endocrinology is nothing if not predictable. And this can happen when growth hormone produced by developing fetal cells actually stimulates their own growth. Based on their structure, hormones can either be hydrophilic or lipophilic, otherwise known as hydrophobic. Hydrophilic hormones dissolve in aqueous solutions like blood. Lipophilic hormones, on the other hand, are lipid rather than water-soluble. So they're insoluble in blood, but can cross lipid-filled cell membranes. Intuitively, the steroid hormones, which are derived from cholesterol, are lipophilic, whereas polypeptide hormones are typically hydrophilic. Most hormones derived from a single amino acid, or the monoamines, are hydrophilic as well. But the thyroid hormones, derived from iodinated tyrosine, break that rule and are instead lipophilic. So, even though peptide, steroid, and amine hormones are made in glands, the synthetic pathway differs for each type. First, peptide hormones like growth hormone and insulin are produced like all other proteins, through DNA transcription into mRNA and the final translation of that mRNA into amino acids. Most large protein hormones like insulin are initially formed as inactive prohormones. A portion of the prohormone must be cleaved off before it can function as a hormone. Second, steroid hormones like estrogen, testosterone, cortisol, and aldosterone are synthesized from cholesterol, which is a flat lipophilic molecule made up of 4 carbon rings. The synthesis of all steroids begins when cholesterol is converted to pregnenolone. Pregnenolone can be transformed into aldosterone, cortisol, and the weak androgens in the adrenal cortex. The strong androgens, testosterone and dihydrotestosterone, are synthesized in the gonads and converted to estrogens in either the ovaries or the peripheral tissues. The hormones derived from single amines, like I mentioned earlier, differ in their solubility. The most important amine hormones are made from the amino acid tyrosine, which itself can be synthesized from the amino acid phenylalanine. The catecholamines are hydrophilic and are produced in the adrenal medulla in a stepwise synthetic pathway that converts tyrosine to L-DOPA, then dopamine, norepinephrine, and epinephrine sequentially. Thyroid hormones, on the other hand, are lipophilic and produced in the thyroid gland through a much more complicated pathway involving the iodination of tyrosine residues and cleavage off a single giant protein precursor called thyroglobulin. All right, I know that's a lot of info, so let's stop here for a pop quiz. What is an example of a steroid hormone? Steroid hormones include cortisol, aldosterone, the weak androgens, testosterone, and estradiol, to name a few. Part 2. How do hormones travel and act? Since hormones must leave the cell to exert their action, we need to know how they travel and then how they act when they reach their target, whether it be the same cell, an adjacent cell, or a distant cell. For the water-soluble hormones, transport is easy. Since blood is an aqueous medium of water, proteins, salt, and cells, water-soluble hormones can simply dissolve in the blood or interstitial fluid and travel to the target cell to bind to an extracellular receptor. It gets a bit more complicated for the water-insoluble hormones, like steroids and thyroid hormone. Since they can't dissolve in the serum, they must first attach to a water-soluble carrier protein, such as thyroxine-binding globulin for thyroid hormone, transcortin for cortisol, or albumin for aldosterone. The bound-to-free hormone ratio is very high, since the solubility in water is low. For example, in thyroid hormone, about 99.5% of the hormone is bound to proteins at any given time. But even though the free fraction is very small, it's the only biologically active form, since only the free hormone can then cross the cell membrane to bind to an intracellular receptor. When the hormone reaches the target cell, its water or lipid solubility is important to its function, as it will determine if a molecule can cross the cell membrane on its own or not. Hydrophilic molecules cannot cross the cell membrane, so they instead bind to transmembrane receptors. This triggers a conformation change in the receptor that alters its shape on the inside of the cell as well, setting off a cascade of intracellular events that alter the cell's physiology. In contrast, lipophilic hormones can freely diffuse through the target cell membrane into the cell. There, they bind to an intracellular target receptor in the nucleus. This means that they don't use an intracellular second messenger to achieve their intracellular effect. Instead, the hormone receptor complex moves directly to the nucleus and binds to a specific nuclear receptor. Once bound to the receptor, the steps to gene activation differ between hydrophilic and lipophilic hormones. Like I mentioned earlier, hydrophilic hormones bind to a cell membrane receptor and then use an intracellular signaling pathway called a secondary messenger to create the desired effect. And this can be achieved not only by gene activation or suppression, but also by activating existing enzymes and channels within the cell to rapidly alter its physiology. Now, one important class of transmembrane receptor is the G-protein coupled receptor, or GPCR. When the hormone binds to the intracellular side, the receptor changes shape and exposes a G-protein binding site on the intracellular side. The variation in the GPCR-associated secondary messenger signal revolves around three different types of G-protein that can bind to the intracellular side. The S subtype activates adenylyl cyclase, which converts adenosine triphosphate to cyclic adenosine monophosphate, or CAMP. This goes on to activate protein kinase A and causes multiple downstream effects depending on the cell, including an increase in intracellular calcium. Now, if you know the S subtype, then the I subtype is easy. It basically does the opposite by blocking the initial activation of adenylyl cyclase. So the GS and GI pathways are used by a range of hormones like the catecholamines, follicle-stimulating hormone, luteinizing hormone, and adrenocorticotropic hormone. The one oddball is the Q subtype, which uses phospholipase C. And this breaks apart the membrane phospholipid called PIP into the membrane-bound diacylglycerol and the cytoplasmic inositol triphosphate, or IP3. The increased diacylglycerol goes on to activate phosphokinase C that acts to promote gene transcription. IP3 goes on to liberate calcium from the endoplasmic reticulum, resulting in an increase in intracellular calcium. And this pathway is used by thyrotropin-releasing hormone, or TRH, and angiotensin II. Now, this is a good time to mention that a single hormone can affect different cells in different ways, depending on the type of receptor it binds to. For example, antidiuretic hormone activates the GS pathway via the V2 receptor, causing the insertion of aquaporins into the cell membranes of the collecting tubule cells. But it also activates the GQ pathway in vascular smooth muscle via the V1 receptor, causing vasoconstriction that gives it the alternate name vasopressin. By the way, that's how epinephrine can simultaneously cause vasoconstriction in most vascular beds via the alpha-1 receptor, and vasodilation in the liver and heart via the beta-2 receptor. I know. How can it possibly get any cooler than this? Anyway, curb your enthusiasm. It's time for a knowledge check. What secondary messenger mechanism does norepinephrine use? As a water-soluble catecholamine from the amine family, norepinephrine uses a G-protein-coupled receptor using KEMP as a secondary messenger. Now moving on to lipophilic hormones. While these hormones are pretty complicated in the way they need to be transported through the blood, when they reach the cell, the way they work is actually pretty simple. They can cross the cell membrane freely to reach the cytosol, then bind to an intracellular receptor. Initially bound to a chaperone protein, the hormone receptor GR complex then enters the nucleus, where it binds to hormone response elements on the target gene, either repressing or enhancing transcription. Part 3. How do cells respond to hormonal activation? Next, let's examine the factors affecting target cell response to hormones, along with different interactions between hormones at the cellular level. First, adaptation allows a target cell to adjust itself to hormone levels. For example, if a gland is constantly underproducing a hormone, then the target cell can increase the number of receptors so that a balanced response can occur, and this is called upregulation. On the other hand, if a gland overproduces a hormone, then the target cell can downregulate the number of receptors, a phenomenon known as desensitization. This is part of the physiology that leads to alcohol and drug tolerance, and it's also why patients often experience withdrawal symptoms when the high levels of receptor-stimulating drug are withdrawn. Another important aspect of hormone action is the additive or inhibitory effect of different hormones acting simultaneously on one target cell or organ. And this can be broken down into permissive, synergistic, and antagonistic effects. Permissive effects refer to one hormone or molecule being required for another molecule to act at full capacity. One essentially gives permission for the other. For example, thyroid hormone upregulates beta-adrenergic receptors on target cells, thus permitting epinephrine to exert its maximal effects. Synergistic effects occur when two hormones working together produces an effect greater than the sum of their individual effects. A classic example of this is the effect of the reproductive hormones on the female body. Estrogen from the ovaries, in combination with FSH from the anterior pituitary gland, produces greater stimulatory maturation on the female ova than either of these hormones does on its own. Finally, antagonistic effects refer to hormones with opposing effects. The simplest example of this is the antagonistic effect of insulin and glucagon on serum blood sugar. These hormones are both produced in the pancreas by neighboring cells, but glucagon works to break down glycogen stores in the liver and body, whereas insulin works to store glucose as glycogen. Therefore, when it comes to blood glucose levels, the two hormones are said to be antagonistic. Part 4. How does the body regulate hormone secretion? Hormone secretion can occur through a humoral, hormonal, or neural stimulus. A humoral stimulus refers to changes in serum composition, for example, different serum concentrations of ions, that eventually leads to hormone release. For instance, in the case of high serum osmolality, changes in transmembrane sodium concentration in the hypothalamus stimulate the release of ADH from the adjacent posterior pituitary gland. ADH then acts on the collecting ducts of the kidneys to increase water reabsorption, diluting the blood and lowering the serum osmolality. With hormonal control, a released hormone causes the release of a second hormone. And the hypothalamic pituitary axis is the classic example of this. For example, corticotropin-releasing hormone is secreted from the hypothalamus during times of stress to stimulate the anterior pituitary gland, which then secretes ACTH. This, in turn, acts on the adrenal gland to release cortisol. This three-step hormone release is part of the fight-or-flight response to stress that stimulates cortisol release. Finally, neural regulation refers to the release of hormones when the cells are stimulated by nerves. And one example of this is the stimulation of gastrin in the stomach during the rest-and-digest parasympathetic period. The vagus nerve synapses onto G cells and stimulates them to release gastrin when it's time to eat. All right, time for a knowledge check. What is humoral stimulation? With humoral stimulation, a change in body composition is detected by the cells of the glands and eventually leads to hormone release. Last on our list of topics for the day is feedback, which refers to the stimulatory or inhibitory effect that either a hormone or one of its effects has on the original stimulus. Positive feedback means that the effect triggers more stimulation of hormone release. And one example of this is childbirth, when the onset of labor causes continuous increase in oxytocin secretion. In the much more common negative feedback, the released hormone feeds back on the original stimulus to stop secretion. And this sort of feedback is most common because it ensures homeostasis in the body. For example, the hypothalamus secretes thyrotropin-releasing hormone that promotes the anterior pituitary to release thyroid-stimulating hormone. TSH binds to receptors on the thyroid gland itself and stimulates the production of thyroid hormones T3 and T4. When the cells in the hypothalamus and pituitary glands sense that T3 and T4 levels have increased, then they release less TRH and TSH, halting the increase in thyroid hormone secretion. And that's a wrap. Let's see what you guys learned about the wide world of hormones, your friends and mine. First, can you provide two different classification schemes for hormones, first by site of activity and second by solubility? Hormone activity can be classified as endocrine, paracrine, or autocrine, based on whether they act on distant, nearby, or the same cells that secrete them. Hormones can also be classified as hydrophilic or lipophilic, depending on whether they're water or lipid soluble. Polypeptide hormones are hydrophilic, and steroid hormones are lipophilic. Most amine hormones are hydrophilic as well, but thyroid hormones are the exception to this rule. And the distinction between hydrophilic and lipophilic ends up being a very important classification, since it determines not only how the hormone is transported through the blood, but also how it acts on cells. Speaking of which, can you contrast how hydrophilic and lipophilic hormones affect target cells? Hydrophilic hormones bind to the extracellular region of a transmembrane receptor, causing a conformation change that affects the intracellular portion of the receptor and sends a signal cascade through the cell. Lipophilic hormones need a transport protein to circulate in the blood, but can enter the cell crossing the cell membrane and bind to nuclear receptors to achieve their desired effects. Finally, can you describe two ways in which a cell can alter its own response to a hormone? A cell can either upregulate or downregulate its receptors in response to persistently decreased or increased levels of hormones, respectively. A cell can also exert positive or negative feedback on the gland secreting the hormone that stimulates it. Now, armed with your newfound knowledge, let's get back to that patient from the intro. A 32-year-old female complaining of palpitations, heat intolerance, and diarrhea asks you why her TSH levels would be low if you think she has hyperthyroidism. How do you explain her lab results to her in a way that she can understand? You explain to your patient that the body is constantly trying to reach a state of equilibrium. It's like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, you tell her. Your body doesn't want to run too hot or too cold. It wants to be just right. You explain briefly how the levels of thyroid hormone in the body are controlled by the pituitary gland, that when it senses high levels of thyroid hormone, it tries to dial down the thyroid stimulation. But in your case, you tell her, I suspect your thyroid stopped listening to the pituitary gland. It's just doing its own thing now, secreting too much thyroid hormone no matter what the pituitary tells it. But that doesn't stop your pituitary from trying to dial down the levels of thyroid hormone by decreasing your thyroid stimulating hormone as much as possible. She nods and thanks you for explaining. And that's our show. If you like what you heard, make sure to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Remember, your feedback helps us improve. You can enjoy the full BRICS experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already. Until next time, friends.